the Initial Reaction podcast, where JP and I are furiously deleting all incriminating evidence that exists of us in the past several years on social media, just to be safe, just in case we're drafted. I'm J.R. Radcliffe from Lake Country Publications and Now Newspapers.
I'm JP Gudorn with Time Warner Cable Sports Channel, and I don't do anything that is illegal, so I'm pretty good.
Well, I mean, I guess I don't either, but maybe there's something I've said or something I've done. We all know how dangerous social media is, and in fact, who knows? I don't think this particular video that we are referring to was even on social media until some hacker or some malicious person got a hold of it and threw it on there. So maybe we just need to delete all videos of us ever.
Yeah, if we went by anything that I said, I mean, I wouldn't have had this job longer than like 2 weeks. Just due to pure dumbness.
Yes, I agree with that. Also, you did just turn 30 this weekend, and you attended a wedding on your 30th birthday. I have to think you were up to no good at some point that weekend.
I did, and I even gave a best man speech on my 30th, golden 30th birthday.
Really? So that's exciting.
It was and I battled strep throat in the meantime, so I really just kind of captured all emotions in one there.
That's
pretty much everything.
Yes, that's a very, very heavy weekend. What was the highlight of your best man speech? First of all, did you go funny or did you go serious? You didn't go serious, did you?
I went pretty funny. Obviously ended serious, but what was the highlight?
Yeah, I mean, what was the big line that got everybody laughing? Tell me you had one.
There were several. It was a constant going out, making a joke, bringing it back in, go out, get another one, bring it back in. It just kept flowing nicely. I was proud. It was some good work.
The consummate performer, JP Gudorn. Have you ever given a best man speech before?
No, that was numero uno.
Yeah, I have given one in my life, and I gotta say, I feel very selfish saying this, but it was probably one of the, like, 15 greatest moments of my life, even though it had not, you know, it wasn't my wedding. But, oh man, that was so much fun. Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
You probably were pretty bad, too, which is funny.
You know, you could say that, JP, but the truth is, you just don't know me very well. I'm a very funny person when I want to be.
Are you, though?
So the NFL draft brought us a number of interesting storylines this week. Notably, we'll talk about, of course, what happened on day one of the draft, which is what everybody was talking about a little bit. I also sat down with Caitlin Moyer, who's in charge of new media for the Milwaukee Brewers. She's got a very interesting line of work. She's basically in charge of exactly what the title suggests: Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, I guess to a degree, Snapchat, anything the Brewers are doing to get their sort of promote their brand a little bit. Also, what the players are doing to promote themselves. She's in charge of all of that. So we'll talk to her a little bit. Kind of ties into what happened at the NFL draft on Tuesday, which is the reference we've made here at the beginning of the podcast. But in the meantime, we should talk about a couple guys from our area, from the Milwaukee area, who were drafted on, that would have both been on Saturday. Joe Schobert went to the Cleveland Browns with the 99th overall pick, first pick of the fourth round. He's a Waukesha West product, the first West graduate to get drafted in the NFL. And Derek Watt of Pewaukee, younger brother of J.J. Watt, but also a fullback at the University of Wisconsin. Schobert, a linebacker at Wisconsin. Derek Watt went in the sixth round to the San Diego Chargers. We talked about Derek Watt a little bit when we were talking about the pro day for UW, for Wisconsin. And I kind of got the sense, and I was sort of on board with this, we wouldn't have been surprised if Derek had gone undrafted and wound up signing as an undrafted free agent somewhere, because it didn't seem like he would – we didn't really know what position he would be in the NFL. We didn't know for sure if teams would value him enough to take him, whereas they probably could get a fullback slash long snapper slash whatever as an undrafted free agent. So were you still surprised when he got taken in the sixth round by San Diego?
Yeah, I was very surprised. That Derek was a great college player and also, you know, a great kid, as I've gotten to know him a little bit. But I just didn't think that he had that great of a role in the NFL, because he is a little bit shorter than pretty much everybody else in the league, and fullback is a dying breed, and you usually wouldn't see a team. It wouldn't be surprising that if he were to make a roster, but to use an actual draft pick to take him just seemed a bit of a reach. But I'm thrilled for the guy. I mean, he is very good at what he does, which is go out there and block, and he's also a great receiving threat out of the backfield. So I think he does have a place on an NFL roster. I was just surprised that he got drafted. So happy for him to go out to San Diego. Obviously, the connection there is that he will potentially have a chance to block for Melvin Gordon, which he is familiar with. So again, thrilled, surprised, but not surprised that he's going to get a shot.
Melvin Gordon did not actually score a touchdown this past year, which was a surprise when I saw that. Ran for 672 yards, I think, but the Chargers were the worst team in the NFL in yards per carry. So if anybody needs help improving the running game, it's them. I don't know if Derek Watt's going to be starting at fullback on day one. He'll probably get a lot of action on special teams, which would probably be the case for a lot of guys drafted in the fourth round or later. But there is a history with the Badgers, and their fullbacks in the past have been successful, have been drafted into the NFL, have been quality players. So, and I have to think the name Watt, I'm sure he doesn't want to talk about this ad nauseum, the fact that his older brother is an NFL superstar. I'm sure that carried a little weight too. I mean, there is a bloodline there that you have to acknowledge.
Yeah, and he did, and obviously it came up at Pro Day. Do you think JJ is going to talk to any teams on your behalf? Do you think that's going to help you at all? And I mean, it's kind of like what is he supposed to say? Like, of course, yeah, his brother wants what's best for him, but teams aren't drafting JJ. They're drafting a completely different player who has a completely different body type. If anybody, TJ Watt is starting to look identical to JJ, both in terms of their actual face and their body. And that's what I still remember. I did a story, I want to say it was probably 2010, and I went and talked to JJ after a Badgers game, and I talked to Derek and TJ, and at the time Pewaukee head coach Clay Iverson for a story. So I did a story on all three of them, and at that time JJ and Derek both said, out of any of us, TJ has a chance to be the best because of the way that his body is currently shaped and the way that it could be shaped and the talent that he has. So if anybody should be getting JJ comparisons, it is TJ, and he certainly is looking the part so far in spring ball.
No doubt in my mind that in 2 years we're talking about TJ Watt getting selected in the NFL draft.
Oh, absolutely.
In conversation, assuming he stays healthy. Health has sort of been his issue, but no doubt in my mind we're going to be talking about that. However,
he has a chance to be really, really good. I mean, he has the potential for the breakout season on this Badgers team.
Yeah, no doubt. Imagine him and Vince Beagle. Beagle really could have been taken in this NFL draft had he elected to make himself available. That's going to be an amazing 1-2 punch on that Badgers defense next year. I'm really excited to see
their linebackers are going to be really good.
So getting back to Derek, it is kind of, I won't say unusual, but it is interesting that they are, like you say, completely different players in terms of size, in terms of what they do on the field, and even like personality-wise, at least when they were at Pewaukee. I mean, JJ is notorious for this never-ending type A motor, 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 motor. Derek is much more laid back, and that's not a bad thing. They're just different. It's how he approaches. He doesn't get rattled by anything. Not that JJ does. It's just he's just a different kind of cat, and at least he was when he was at Pewaukee. And when he was with the Pirates, he was a running back. He was a linebacker. He's played a lot of different positions on the field. And JJ has too, to some degree, but obviously much smaller and still very bulky and very, very strong. So just an interesting that even though they do have that same last name, there's just nothing similar about the way they play football. They'll obviously be on other opposite sides of the ball, which is even more interesting knowing that the two teams are going to face off. I mean, if he makes the Chargers roster, Derek does, they'll face each other, I want to say November 26th. It's sometime in that Thanksgiving region. The Houston Texans and San Diego Chargers are scheduled to meet. That would be a very interesting week for the Watt family.
Yeah, that might be really fun. I also don't really anticipate that going well for Derek if they end up meeting in a field with JJ with a 3-yard head start. I don't imagine that ending well.
How crazy would it be for Derek to try to, to be in a situation to have to block his brother?
Yeah.
That would be fascinating.
Where literally, not only can nobody in the NFL block him right now, but now you have to block him and you're 4 inches shorter and you've been around him your whole life. That will be crazy.
Especially, we've really seen up close their relationship. They're very close. All the Watt brothers are very close, the family in general, and that's just interesting. And then consider what happens the week after that. The Houston Texans come to Green Bay. It'll be J.J. Watt's first pro game at Lambeau Field. I mean, there's just a lot going on there for the city of Pewaukee, the Watt family. That's an interesting run right there.
That's fantastic. That's going to be really fun.
Watt's teammate Joe Schobert was taken with the first pick of the third day of the draft. There was some thought he maybe could sneak into that late third round. with even the Green Bay Packers actually had a late pick in the third round, and they took a linebacker that could have been Joe Schobert. It was looking interesting that way, but he does go with the first pick of the fourth round. The joke being he's going to the Cleveland Browns, and sort of a death sentence for a lot of young football players. But great to see this kid, Joe Schobert. He's not huge for a linebacker, but definitely had that motor at Wisconsin, built himself from a walk-on into a star at Wisconsin, and it's hard not to imagine that he'll have some success in the NFL.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that he didn't go earlier. I know he didn't miss by much of going in the third round, but I really thought he was a second-night kind of guy. I mean, he was the linebacker of the year in the Big Ten. He was an All-American. There was really nothing he can't do. I think it was a quote in the paper the other day of just watch his Iowa tape. And if you just watch what he did in that one game, that's enough to make you go, holy cow, maybe we should have this guy on our team. Cause he was just so good that one day. And then, I mean, he was amazing that day. And then he was so good the rest of the year that I was a little surprised that he didn't go higher. I do think he has an NFL career ahead of him. I don't think that this is by any means a bust of a pick. And I don't think it's even anything that's, you know, just one or two years and then fade out once they get somebody better. I think that he could be in the league for probably 5 or 6 years, maybe more, if he does what I think he's capable of doing.
His story, rise to fame, is sort of canonical in terms of high school sports fandom. People who know high school football in Milwaukee kind of know his story, where he was all set to go to North Dakota as a walk-on. That's an FCS program, North Dakota. And then at the Wisconsin Football Coaches Association All-Star Game, this is the summer before he's about to leave. This is weeks before he's about to leave for college. The coaches loved what he was doing in practice, talked to Brett Bielema, who was the coach at Wisconsin at the time, convinced him to take Schobert as a walk-on there. And he became a player on special teams, obviously rose into being the best linebacker in the Big Ten, and like you said, All-American. And you talked about the Iowa game. The moment for me that really resonates was his junior year in the bowl game against Auburn, when the Badgers beat Auburn in overtime. On the overtime series, the Badgers had already scored, had kicked a field goal. Auburn went backwards on their three downs. Joe Schobert made tackles on all three plays. I believe it was a no gain, maybe a 2 yard gain, a 2 yard loss, or maybe there were two losses and a no gain. I don't know, but he made the play, made an actual play on all three downs, and then Auburn sends the kick wide. Wisconsin wins the bowl game, which was an upset. I believe Barry Alvarez was coaching that one. That was after Brett Bielema had left. So that was, to me, that was the highlight of Schobert's, you know, Schobert's career in terms of sort of an individual game or an individual moment. I love the fact that he built himself into a situation where you knew he was going to get drafted. It wasn't necessarily, you didn't know, maybe he'd fall to the fifth or maybe he'd go as early as the third, but he was the one Wisconsin Badger that you could say without a doubt, that kid is getting drafted.
Yeah, which is really weird that, first of all, it's the first time the Badgers have been shut out of the first three rounds since 2010, back when Garrett Graham was the first draft pick and it was the fourth round. And it's surprising again that they only had two players drafted. I mean, I guess I'm not saying that Joel Stavi should have been drafted or that Tyler Mayers or Alex Erickson should have been drafted. It's just kind of surprising when you look at years when they've had five, six, seven guys, when they haven't been necessarily that much better of a team. And then you look at this past year and there's only two. So I just thought that both of those were kind of weird, but, again, obviously just happy for Joe as a person. He's somebody that you and I have both covered, dating all the way back to high school when he broke the state title game rushing record and through his time. You know, I was at the All-Star game. I interviewed him, and I think his teammate was, Daniel. I think, I can't remember. But anyway, I interviewed him and his teammates because they were both going to North Dakota together. So I remember that day and just how quickly things change, and you realize, wow, this kid is all of a sudden going to Wisconsin. You know, good luck. But the way that he worked at it and accomplished what he did, I think is phenomenal. And now he gets to be an NFL player. There's only a certain, you know, we can say what we want about Cleveland, but that's one of 32 teams and that's one of 32, places for him to land. So I'm happy for him. Really happy for him.
First time in history that two Waukesha County players were taken in the same NFL draft. You can find my stories on Watt and Schobert at Lake Country Now and WaukeshaNow.com respectively. Got a rundown of all the Waukesha County draftees that I can round up. There might be some sort of outliers from the 30s and 40s that I haven't tracked down yet, but you could see all of that on our website. And you said it about this Badgers team, because they had guys like Michael Caputo, Tanner McAvoy, guys who signed as undrafted free agents pretty much right away. Shelton was another one, Sojourn Shelton. But I don't think they were that much worse than other teams that have had tons of high draft picks. They were really just as good as they've always been. And even going forward, I'm not sure they have a ton of draftees coming out next year or the year after that, per se, and they're still going to be right there in the conversation.
Yeah, I've been saying this for a couple of weeks, that I think kind of ever since Pro Day, that there were a lot of really good college players on this team, but not a lot of NFL players. And that's nothing, I mean, it sounds like I'm trying to rip on this team or whatever, but that's not a bad thing. I mean, that's better than a lot of other college teams had. Some college teams didn't have a lot of good college players. This team, I mean, a guy like Darius Hillary, a ton of starting experience, was a good college player. He's just not a pro, you know? I mean, somebody like Michael Caputo, really, really good college player, and I think probably should have been a pro player, but that's when you realize just how tough it is to make it in this league, because for every guy that's good enough on the Badgers, there's somebody from Utah State who's amazing, you know, that is playing on a bad team, but is just a phenomenal player. And there's all those players like that that end up taking these spots.
Yeah, I think I said Sojourn Shelton. I definitely meant Hillary. But yeah, I agree with you. Sometimes when you say a guy isn't a pro player, it's got nothing to do with how good he is. It has everything to do with his measurables, because no matter how good you are, there's always going to be that, you know, you're not big enough, you're not tall enough, you just don't run fast enough. That stuff is always going to play a role. And I mean, look at Ohio State, who had a million NFL draft picks, and they ended up, you know, that team didn't beat Michigan State, and they had how many kids taken in the first and second round. It doesn't always matter who, in terms of college wins and losses, how many NFL kids you have on your team. So yeah, that's it's probably both a good thing and a bad thing for the Badger program to be in this situation.
Yeah, a relatively down year for the Ohio State Buckeyes.
Relatively down. It was not they didn't win the national title, but they were fine. Man, Cardale Jones took a drop, huh? And Connor Cook too, Michigan State. You just in football, yeah, especially, you almost just have to come out when people are talking about you, because it is a precipitous fall if you struggle in your final year.
Which also means Christian Hackenberg shouldn't have even played college football, because every year it just kind of his luster went down just a little bit every year. And yeah, Cook and Hackenberg were really surprising with how far they fell.
Yeah, no doubt. So the NFL first round was super fascinating and almost had nothing to do with the player. Well, it did have something to do with the players taken, because right before the draft started, Laramie Tunsil, an offensive lineman from Ole Miss, which is just a hotbed for weirdness and all kinds of trouble. His teammate Robert Kendiche, who was taken later in the first round, there's a huge backstory there too. It was posted on Laramie Tunsil's Twitter account, a video of him with a like what looked like a gas mask and marijuana. Somehow marijuana is getting piped into this thing. So it's apparently a video from 2 years ago. It lands on Twitter right before the draft. Somebody put it there with the intent of sabotaging Tunsil's draft stock. Presumably, it worked, because Tunsil fell from what was thought of as a top three, top five slot all the way to number 13, where the Miami Dolphins took him. And then after he's taken, on Instagram, there appeared to be text messages, exchanges with a coach at Ole Miss asking for money for rent and various other things. And ultimately, when he's asked about it, before anybody could whisk him away, he kind of copped to it. He kind of said, yeah, I have to say, yeah, I took money. You know, I had coaches help me out. So crazy, like scandalous first round of the draft night. And again, the thought is that somebody is trying to sabotage them. They've talked about maybe being a stepfather. It's just this circus. It was crazy. I mean, we've never seen anything like that. I'm not sure we'll ever see anything like that again.
Yeah, that's a good point, that normally I hate you and your exaggerations on things, but yeah.
You don't,
I don't
hate
know
me or my exaggerations.
Agree to disagree. I'm pretty confident in saying that we will not see another first round draft pick in a gas mask bong again. I'm pretty sure,
yes,
that won't happen. Just a crazy, like, you can't believe what's happening next type scenario. But then again, it's also like not surprising. Like, oh, okay, somebody from Ole Miss broke some rules and is crazy doing weird things. Yeah, got it. SEC football makes us ashamed to be Americans. Yeah, sure. That sounds about right. It's a weird night, and you talked about his draft stock sliding. Now Baltimore has come out and said that they were prepared to take him 6th overall until that came over, and then he ends up slotting to 13. So, weird night.
Very weird. It did go as expected at the top, where Carson Wentz went number 2, the North Dakota State quarterback, behind Jared Goff, who was the first overall pick, the California quarterback, going to Los Angeles to play for the Rams, but after that, it was kind of everybody's guess, and there's the whole Miles Jack thing where it was thought that injuries might limit where he gets taken, but people still thought he was a top 10 pick, and then he slides all the way out of the first round. A lot of Packers fans were hopping on the Miles Jack train, really hoping that Ted Thompson would draft him. Of course, they went instead with Kenny Clark, a defensive lineman from UCLA. When you did, I don't know if you watched this, but I mean, it's easy. It's so easy to get caught up in that. To want a player is falling, and you just so badly, oh, you want him to follow the Packers because he's a position of need, and he's a great player, and obviously the Packers will take him, right, if they get that far. And it's so hard to fight that instinct that tells you, you know, it's not like people aren't aware, other teams aren't aware how good he is. If he's falling this far, it's probably because the injury thing is legit. I mean, it really could be a problem. And so you, especially when he falls all the way out of the first round and you think, well, 31 different teams had a chance to take a shot at him and didn't do it, you got to think that that's the right call. But, man, it's so hard to not want the Packers to jump in on that and take Miles Jack the way they did in 2005 when Aaron Rodgers fell to them.
Yeah, the Packers pick was weird because as it went on, you kind of got the sense, even when there were about 10 picks until the Packers pick, you kind of got the sense that, wow, I think they're going to have a lot of choices here. That sometimes, for instance, completely different, but with the Bucks, whenever they're picking this year, like if they're not in the top 3, it really doesn't even matter because there's like nobody right that you can possibly get excited about. But with the Packers, the way that the draft was falling, you're looking at names like Ragland and Jack and all these guys that are still there, and you're like, holy cow, they're going to get a good player here. And then obviously ended up picking Clark, which I think was a little bit of a curveball, but still there were, I mean, that makes you realize how much they liked him when there were plenty of other names on the board and they selected him. You think, holy cow, they must have really liked who they got.
No doubt. Vernon Butler is another guy, Andrew Billings, who fell, I want to say, all the way to the 4th round. That was a real head scratcher because there weren't those injury questions around him and he just kept dropping. There were a lot of guys that were linked to the Packers, and almost all of them, I would say, were available at that pick.
Yeah.
So sort of an embarrassment of riches. Does sound like Clark was the guy they wanted, and they were going to take him pretty much regardless if he was available. So that sounds good. I mean, I wish I could say that I knew anything about the guy and would be able to project how he's going to do in the NFL. Lots of other people try to do that, but in reality, it's just this type of thing that has to play out. And even if you go back, I was thinking, well, and some people do this, really you should just go back and review the draft 4 years ago or 3 years ago. But even then, you don't remember the context. You don't remember, well, this guy fell because he had a bad pro day or he had some questions about his character and stuff like that. You just don't remember why it fell. It's very easy to say, oh, the Packers should have drafted this quarterback who went one spot later and became an all-star or pro bowler, I should say. It's really easy to do that, but it's just a very difficult thing to get your arms around at the time. It's very hard to gauge.
Yeah, and I think this draft was weird because, there was nothing really exciting about the Bucks draft or the
right.
Bucks, the Packers draft. But I think it was effective. You know, picking a backup offensive lineman as early as they did is the least exciting thing you could possibly do. But I think it is a you know, I'm glad that they made that pick. You know, I think Spriggs fits in
definitely
to the future of this franchise. So again, that's not exciting at all, but I think it is an effective draft.
Totally agree with you. And I think are we at the point where we can safely say that the best player available concept that Ted Thompson bandies about, it's not really true necessarily. I mean, the best player available at their position or at their draft slot was Miles Jack, but he was hurt. And they went with somebody else who could do something in another position they needed. They needed an offensive lineman. They needed an inside linebacker. They needed another linebacker just because they were out of them completely last year. They needed some wide receiver depth. I guess by the time you get to like the 5th and 6th round, it sort of is the best player available. It's like, well, we kind of need everything in some way, shape, and form, so we'll just take what we think is the best player. But they addressed their needs in this draft just like they did last year when they needed secondary help and came away with Demaryius Randall, Quentin Rollins, and the year before that when they needed a safety and they got Ha-Ha Clinton Dix. I mean, we're getting to the point where that best player available concept, it really and Rob Reichel said this on the podcast last week, it's really more like the best player available at a position of need, which of course makes perfect sense. That's how all teams primarily are drafting most of the time.
Yeah, I would only agree if you consider that the backup offensive line was a bigger need than inside linebacker, which I don't agree with. So, you know, you're saying that they basically needed that backup lineman more than they needed to draft somebody else, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because at that point I think that they had Spriggs rated higher than any of their linebackers in that late second round, and that's why they took him. You know, that's what's frustrating to me, is that yes, I concede that you do need a backup lineman at some point because you don't have that depth, not to mention the free agency class that's going to be hitting next year. But I think you needed that inside backer more than you needed that lineman, and that bothers me a little bit, because I'm not saying that, I think it was Martinez, right, from Stanford?
Yeah.
Not saying that he can't be the guy, and there's no reason to doubt him until he gives you reason to doubt him, but that bothers me, that you could have taken an inside backer three times before you look to the future of this team. With the outside backer, you're preparing for life without Julius Peppers. I don't think that's the right move to make. I don't think you should be worrying about next year's outside linebacker before you worry about this year's inside linebacker. So it did bother me a little bit.
I actually am going to disagree with you on that. I think the backup lineman is more important than the inside linebacker, and not necessarily because of my own assessment, but given the fact that they didn't draft a guy last year until the later rounds when they needed that position glaringly, given the fact that A.J. Hawk was their guy for years and years, I just don't think, and Elliot Wolf even sort of alluded to this in one of the press conferences, I don't think the Packers really put a lot of stock in that position. I don't think they feel like that position is crucial to a quality defense, to a winning team. And maybe that's erroneous on their part, but that's how they've treated that position. Because you don't, if the position is essentially vacant for three some years and the team is still winning, now maybe that's correlation and not causation, but maybe you could say they just really don't care to fill it. And on the other hand, the offensive line, we saw what happens when that offensive line is tattered like it was this past year without a clear backup, without two or three clear backups. I mean, Aaron Rodgers is the most valuable commodity on the team. No one disputes this. I think it's not unfair to say the second greatest commodity is the guy who keeps him from getting knocked over and potentially getting hurt. Maybe they do think the backup offensive lineman, the future offensive lineman, is more important than the inside linebacker. I actually think that's a defensible position.
Well, yeah, I think you can make a better case for the offensive lineman more so than the outside linebacker. Would you agree with that?
I mean, yes,
I would concede the offensive line, that at least if you went D tackle, offensive line, inside backer, then outside backer, I would feel a lot better. This is really nitpicking, and it really doesn't matter, but that would make me feel much better about how Ted Thompson and his staff are addressing this team and still trying to capitalize on what should be another competitive season, as long as they don't screw things up.
Yeah, there's also that line of thinking that the great defensive linemen sometimes make linebackers look really good, and sometimes the linebacker comes up with all the production and you assume he's the star, but it's those guys up front that you don't think about at all. Same with offensive line. Those guys don't get a lot of glory, and that's understood, but sometimes they're the reason things are happening. So it will be interesting, and in 3 to 5 years we'll be able to say whether or not it was the right move. So set your watches for that moment. So with social media being definitely the story on the NFL draft opening night, we kind of segue here to another person who deals very closely with social media. Caitlin Moyer of the Milwaukee Brewers was curious to know a little bit about her job, what she does with the players, with sort of promoting the brand. We talked about Hank the Dog, of course, and a few other fun things. So give a listen to our conversation, and we will be back after that. My guest is Caitlin Moyer, Director of New Media for the Milwaukee Brewers. And Caitlin, I feel like we're kind of kindred spirits because you started interning with the Brewers in 2003. I interned with the Brewers in 2003, media relations, but you are still here. And we were actually just talking how your job has changed a little bit. Director of New Media is a position that has existed for 3 years, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And what were the stepping stones to get there? You were in marketing and then kind of moved around. I mean, how did it evolve?
I started out as an intern and I was in the corporate marketing department, so sort of the sponsorship world. I still had to finish up some school, so I became part of the brew crew, so the in-game promotion squad.
So were you actually racing sausage?
Yes.
Awesome.
With, you know, dancing on the dugout.
Nice. Throwing t-shirts at the people.
T-shirts at the people, all that kind of stuff.
Perfect.
And then when I finished school, they had an opening. It was a seasonal position, so that meant they didn't know if they were going to keep me after the season was over. But it was a marketing coordinator, so it was kind of a jack of all trades. And was lucky enough to get my foot in the door. Became a full-time position over the last few years. We've grown that department. And as technology has evolved, things like Facebook came out, Twitter, et cetera, kind of gravitated to those platforms, absorbed them into marketing, and then it just reached this threshold in about 2012 where we added probably 4 new networks, and it really became apparent that if we want to do this and we want to do it well, we need to kind of invest in the resources. So I shifted over to new media, became the department.
Yes.
And now we're trying to grow that department. I have a coordinator under me this time.
When you say 4 new networks, you're talking about like different social mediums that you
different
guys...
Different platforms. Yeah, I think like we added like Pinterest at the time,
Instagram yeah.
Vine was coming out, all these different things. And it was, you know, really hard to do that on the side with all the other media channels that we had.
Does that mean you were physically running around during game days, taking pictures of fans and stuff like that? Is that something your department still does?
Right now, yeah. Right now we do. You know, I think back to its infancy, it was so different.
Right.
It's kind of interesting to see how it's evolved. But yeah, now it's definitely a full-time plus gig. It never really sleeps.
Right. So one of my favorite things that you did this past year is you had a lip-sync battle between Jeremy Jefferson and Will Smith at Brewers on Deck. Which was great, totally capitalizing on the lip sync thing being a big deal right now. Kind of tell me how that idea evolved. I mean, that has to be one of your better home runs, I would think, in terms of idea generation since you've been here.
Yeah, we just had, it was a perfect storm, you know. We were trying to look up and see, you know, what are some good, fun activities that we could do on the social media stage. We came up with the lip sync battle idea, and right away I knew that Jeremy Jefferis would be the perfect guy for it.
Yeah.
'Cause he's always walking around singing. He's got the outgoing personality. He and Will Smith are best friends. I thought if I could get JJ on board, he could help me get Will.
Yes.
And so it was a little tricky. We had to get them to, you know, pick their songs in advance and maybe rehearse a little bit. But I was able, and this is all in the off season, so this is done via text message to prepare them.
And yeah.
It's a little bit of, hey, I heard that JJ's really been rehearsing. He's adding some dance moves. What are you doing, Will? And, oh, hey, guess what Will's working on? They fed off of each other. They were both really, really good sports. And, you know, that may not have worked so well, you know, with somebody else who may have been shyer, but perfect personalities, those two.
So those two, obviously, helpful. But in general, how often do your pursuits involve the players and how cooperative are they? I'm sure some are different. Everyone's different.
But. Sure. I mean, the players are our biggest asset that we have, and we can put stuff out there all day. But when you put, you know, a player in a T-shirt or a player holding the bobblehead, that makes it so much cooler. And I would say all the guys, 25 guys on the roster, they're all willing to help. To varying degrees, are they involved in their own social media channels? I would say about 80% of the roster is on one platform or another, and I've seen that evolve over time, too, which has been interesting.
It's probably the new guys are Instagram, whereas they were Twitter before that and Facebook before that.
It was, can you get me verified on Twitter? Oh, can you get me verified on Instagram?
Right.
I went from Twitter girl 2 seasons ago. This spring I got named Ms. Instagram. So it probably will be something.
And you'll be Snapchat tomorrow. Yeah.
So it's been very interesting, but yeah, some guys are really, really into it. To talk about Jeremy Jefferis, he's one guy that is all about it. He's
awesome.
My go-to. And then there's other guys that are like, it's not for me, but if I ask him, hey, can I take a quick picture, they're all for it.
So you actually went on this last road trip. I saw some of your own, either on your blog, I think, or just your own Twitter account. You had pictures from the road. This does seem like the type of thing that, I mean, you'd be able to do pretty much anywhere. You wouldn't have to travel with the team. So what is it that you're able to do on the road, and how does that sort of enhance what you're doing?
It's much easier to do it on the road when you're there and you can control the content and take your own pictures and cover it. I mean, we still have to cover the games on social media whether we're there or not. So if we're not there, we have to do our best to make it look like we're there.
Got it.
The media relations guys that always travel, they have a lot of other responsibilities. So we can't rely on them necessarily to send you all that content. MLB does employ different people at each stadium, and they're responsible for gathering content for the home team and for the away team. So I can send in an email that says, hey, this is the kind of pictures I'm looking for. Can you send it to me? But I've had varying degrees of success with that. So it's always better to be there yourself. I don't travel on every trip, but I find that when I do, it's much easier to get things done. Also, yeah. I found that it seems like our guys are a little bit more relaxed on the road. I don't know if it's because we take BP later or what it is, but I'm able to get other things accomplished besides just game content. They'll come up to me and they'll be more relaxed. Hey, Scooter stole my camera the other day and it was great content because he posted the picture.
I saw the picture he took of himself, yes.
Caught two guys stinging in the dugout for Snapchat. So cool. For whatever reason, they kind of open up at times, and it's good to just be there and capture those moments.
So you mentioned that sort of a network with other MLB teams, and I'm sure that they're all in varying stages of their own new media development. Do you feel like the Brewers were a little bit ahead of the curve or right on the curve?
I think we're right on the curve. I think you're going to have your California teams that are kind of sure. leading the charge.
Silicon Valley and whatnot, yeah.
Everyone looks up to the Giants as, the paradigm. But, yeah, we've really tried really hard to stay ahead of the curve, and, you know, when it comes to building our department, you know, I'm always keeping tabs on, you know, this team added another staffer, you know.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Can we get more help? So, yeah, I think, you know, we always try to be a team that others look up to and emulate as well.
The players, I think I heard on another podcast you actually sort of do a social media training with them before the year. So are you monitoring what they do? Kind of, I don't want to say babysitting what they do, but you're sort of shepherding them through the social media world. But at the same time, you're probably kind of in charge of the image of the team uh-huh. with so many different, you know, avenues for that to be a problem. How much does that play into what you do?
Yeah, I do social media training. It used to just be with the minor leaguers, kind of, a little bit of scare tactic, a little bit of,
yeah.
Here are some things that could happen. They're funny as long as they don't happen to you
right.
kind of stuff.
And the minor leaguers have got to be ahead of all of this because they're on the front lines of what's new.
Yeah, they've been growing up with all of this stuff. So, you know, with the younger team and a lot of new faces, we decided, you know, it's really important that we tell everyone the same thing. They all hear it at once. So, you know, just do's and don'ts. You don't want to scare them too much. You want to tell them, you know, how to use it to build their brand, too.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I am the Twitter police. I get literally get a text message every time one of our guys tweets.
Oh, really?
And I can't.
That is a lot of text messages. Oh, my goodness.
A lot of text messages, and I monitor Instagram, too. And if there's something that's,
objectionable, yeah.
I will call the guy and say, hey, you know, what's going on here?
Right.
So thankfully I haven't had to do that, really
right.
more than once or twice that I can recall. I think they know by now that I'm watching, but, yeah, it's scary because it's, you know, a 24-hour thing. You might, you know, be asleep and something might happen.
Yeah.
But that's just part of the job.
You, are obviously with new media catering to a younger crowd. A lot of people will tell you that baseball is having trouble capturing the younger crowd. There isn't really data to support that, but for whatever reason, a lot of people feel that way. Who do you think of when you're thinking of your audience and with your blog, with the social media, and do you feel like baseball is struggling to sort of capture this market?
I think, you know, baseball, it just in general, it has the older demographic. So there are a lot of things about baseball that I think, I don't want to say turn off a younger crowd, but, you know, the pace of the game, things like that we're working on. But I think that when it comes to social media, what you always want to be is where your fans are. Mm-hmm. So we know that our fans are on Twitter, they're on Facebook, etc. And when you look at those platforms, you know that there's different demographics that are associated with those
exactly,
platforms.
Exactly, yeah,
so
for sure.
That's what we more try to look at is, you know, okay, Facebook skews a little bit older, so maybe the content that we funnel through there is going to be a little bit different, a lot different, let's say, than Snapchat.
Oh, no doubt. So one of the things about baseball that I like is there's a lot of games, there are a lot of storylines. Some of them are ridiculous, especially with a month of spring training. This past season's a great example. There was the Hank the Dog fiasco where it was suggested that he may have passed on and been replaced by a new Hank the Dog. I know that's not necessarily directly your department, the marketing department, the Hank phenomenon, but you're going to get cases like that. And go all the way back to 2003 when Randall Simon hit a racing sausage with a bat. Is that, for you and for the people in this organization, is that a crisis or is that sort of an opportunity to have fun with it? And how do you sort of not let it become sort of this dire thing like, oh man, we got to be serious because this is a serious business and, you know, also still know that you got to have fun with it?
I think as an organization, and especially that case, it's easy to have fun with it, right, and to be right. playful. And what I think was so great about how that situation was handled is that we were really able to turn it into a positive for the Humane Society.
Definitely, yep.
So I think above all, you know, it's not just having fun for fun's sake, but it had an end goal
right, yeah.
to it. So I think, you know, there are definitely other situations that you might call like a crisis, and that really wasn't one of them.
Do you, when something like that breaks, I mean, how do you, what action, are you sort of directing people to tell them, okay, let's not freak out about this, well, here's a strategy. Are you in charge of sort of, I don't want to call it crisis management, but is that sort of you as the new media guru to sort of tell people, this is how we're going to present the message?
I'm involved in a lot of the conversations. Mm-hmm. How do we want to present things? A lot of times, since I'm monitoring social media so closely, I might catch news stories or things that break faster and bring them to other people's attention
right.
and say, how do we want to address this? I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily always the one setting the tone, but I'm definitely one of the people at the table.
Okay. Your blog used to have the best name of all baseball blogs. Unfortunately, John Steinmiller, who's now in another organization, but it was John and Kate Plus 9, back when John and Kate Plus 8 was a big thing. Just a great moment in time where you'll have to explain that to somebody down the road. But to me, that was very funny. Now it's like Kate Circles the Bases, I think.
Kate Covers the Bases.
Kate Covers yeah. the Bases. So what is the function of your blog? Because you update it a lot. What are you thinking of? What belongs on the blog that maybe doesn't somewhere else?
Sure, yeah, that's a great question. I'm very proud of the blog. Since John and I started it, we had no idea like what it would become and the function that it would serve. And it's very fortunate actually. When we started it, the goal was they came to us actually and they said, hey, we want you guys to write a blog. And I said, well, that's great, but John has the cool job. John John yeah. travels with the team. John's around the players. I was just more in marketing mm-hmm. at the time. Helping run some of the social media accounts, and John had his hands in it too. But then I figured out a way to turn it around and so I could have the cool part too.
Sure, right.
I kind of took the approach of like girl on the street. So you have people camping out at Miller Park for Field of Sweet Dreams. So I'm going to pitch a tent and I'm going to camp out too. And oh, Arctic Tailgate fans are camping out in the cold. Well, we camped out yeah. again this time, you know, much cooler weather.
This is a brutal job. You got some tough limits here.
You know, we tasted the food and we gave our reviews, right. things like that. So, you know, as you mentioned, John left. This position that I hold evolved. What has really been beautiful about this is that the blog is a great repository for all kinds of different content. It's a quick note about a job fair that we're hosting
sure.
here to a story that I've done in depth. And then on our social channels, we can post one really great picture, let's say on Facebook, with a fun caption. If you're scrolling through your feed and you're like, that's cool, like this post, moving on.
Right.
Or if you're really interested, then you can click the link and you can read the story
right.
Without having to go through the process of getting it up on the website, where it's a lot of the social content is so fleeting. So a good
yeah.
example is today is National Lookalike.
Right, right?
The doppelganger
yep.
thing. So, I mean, it's for one day. It's just some fun content. I created a story. We did some side-by-side photos. Mm. The whole story with quotes from the guys, everything's there. But if you went on Twitter, you saw, like, the photos spread out throughout the day.
Yeah.
People tagged in them. And you could always click through the link to go
right.
back and read more.
That's kind of a good point. I mean, as we've moved away from sort of home pages and landing pages and it's all social media, it's kind of like at some point you kind of want that central hub where you can go back and check some of that stuff out or see all of it at once. So so that's interesting. This maybe is an inside baseball question, literally, but over your 13 years here, have you had a promotion, a marketing, a strategy, something that you thought was going to be great that just went wrong? And then the other side, I mean, have you had something that was a surprise that it took off like it did?
Boy, I wish I had more time to think of this question. Something that went wrong. I would say, I don't know that it went wrong. I don't think it was anything that we did, but if you remember the Where's Bernie?
Yes.
Promotion.
Oh, man, I do. What
yeah.
a disaster that was.
And, I mean, it was
not a real disaster, of course, but
it was just interesting. I mean, we did a scavenger hunt. We planned it as a fun thing for the fans. Unfortunately, one fan kind of ruined it for
yes.
everyone else. Ended up turning it into a charity thing at the end of the
right,
day. But,
right.
you know, a lot of people criticized us at the time, like, oh, couldn't the Brewers have, like, put GPS tracking devices on these things?
like with the budget must be unlimited for you, of course.
Yeah, and it was like, no, that wasn't the point.
Right.
The point was just to do a nice, fun promotion for the fans. And like I said, there's always someone in the bunch that ruins it for everyone else. So I would say that sticks out. But you know what? At the end of the day, we also got a lot of great publicity.
Yeah, you're right.
So I guess, you know, you kind of weigh that into it. Something that's been really good, that's surprising. I'm sure there's a lot of examples with that. One thing that I guess it wasn't surprising, but our countdown campaign has a lot of longevity.
Mm-hmm.
A couple years ago, we started counting down the days with different images from January 1st until opening day, images that were represented in Miller Park, Milwaukee, baseball. And then we invited fans to submit and show how they're counting down. And the campaign has lasted, like, I think we're on year 4. And it's...
That's cool, yeah.
You know, you'll have people the last day of the season, and they'll post a number already. They're starting to
count down
to the next
year.
So
that's
we
neat.
Know that's caught on and taken off. So pretty proud of that one.
So I think kind of the last question here, Snapchat's the easy answer to this question, but you're sort of tapped into all the social media. What comes next? Is there any idea? I mean, we've seen some things like Foursquare that didn't really find a niche forever. We've seen things like Snapchat that had kind of a weird niche and blossomed into something completely different. Do you foresee this? Do you have any idea maybe what 3 years from now what the primary social medium is that you're going to be operating or what it's going
to
look like?
Boy, I wish if I had the answer to that question, I would probably be pretty rich.
A lot of evolution in this job, or a lot of revolution
in
this job.
Definitely keeping on track of everything. But I would say, you know, right now the direction things are going in, it's a lot of live streaming. So Periscope and then Facebook just joined the party with
definitely.
The Facebook Live. So I think that stuff's going to grow a lot, and I also been reading a lot about virtual reality.
Yeah, no doubt. That's everywhere right now.
So, I mean, stay tuned. You know, never know what could come next exactly, but if I had to put money on it, I'd say that's a direction that you'll see more sports teams go towards.
Definitely. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining me.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, I think that was fantastic. I think one of the things about the Brewers that's so intriguing to me is how well they've done in that department. And I'm not saying that's obviously just Caitlin and her staff, but really, I guess it kind of goes back decades, but even more so since Miller Park has been built, that they are trying to build just an atmosphere that you're going to the Brewers game. You're not going to see a win or a loss. You're going because you want to tailgate. And that's obviously why they built Miller Park where they did and how they did with, you know, they didn't want to put it downtown because you couldn't fit 15,000 cars downtown with all their parking spaces. So, you know, they made sure that they made tailgating is an event. It's a thing. It's something that is part of summer and it's part of baseball that even if the team isn't good, which hello, even if the team isn't good, you still want to go tailgate. And then again, that's why they built Miller Park the way that they did. They built a roof on it so that, you know, you're always going to see a game. You're always going to be able to bring your kids over to that right field corner and do their little mini sausage race. That's why they put in the Bud Selig experience, that there's so much more to it. And then you look at the promotions that we just heard about, you know, the bobbleheads, the giveaways, the kids running on the field after the game. There's so much more to it than just baseball. And I think the Brewers are brilliant for doing that.
I definitely agree. And like you've alluded to, especially important in a season where they're not going to win a lot of games. They're going to have to do things more than they already are to attract the fan base. And the Brewers have always been very good at that. It helps having a roof, a climate-controlled environment where you can go rain or shine to the game and not have to worry about making that drive from, you know, Sheboygan or the Fox Cities or even further and worry that your game's going to get rained out when you get there. So that's a nice thing, a certainty thing. And then on top of that, you talked about the tailgating, and they're taking pictures of those tailgaters and putting them on Instagram and Snapchat. I mean, that is, they promote that pretty heavily. The bobbleheads are so huge here. They're not that big in other markets. But for whatever reason, either because the nature of the fans or the way they've been promoted or the way they've been packaged, I don't know. But people love their bobbleheads. I myself have collected all the player bobbleheads since they started, I think, in 02 or 03. 02, I'm pretty sure they started creating them. I mean, I'm into it. A lot of people are into it. Countless people get tickets to those games just to get the bobbleheads, which is crazy because that doesn't happen in other markets, but it happens here. So they are ahead of the game, have been ahead of the game, and like she sort of alluded to, every team kind of has a presence now, and they're working together. They're collaborating to sort of help each other out, and make sure there are lots of pictures of opposing fans in the various ballparks that can be sent back home, because they're covering games on social media whether or not they're at Miller Park. So it's a very interesting avenue, and it's a big thing in our business too. We sort of talk about this a lot, how social media has changed the game for us and how we have to adapt to it. It's something that I think all businesses are thinking about.
And I also flash back to, I believe it was like the day before the home opener, that there were players out distributing tickets, like leaving them on car windshields and stuff. So even more giveaways that come to mind of just how well they're doing of, I think it's kind of like, listen, we know that we're not very good. We're trying to make it up to you by giving you free stuff, you know, and I think that's the way to go. I think they're doing a perfect job.
Kids eat free on Sunday. I didn't even
know
that.
It's unreal.
That's awesome. I will be taking my children on a Sunday because that is a draw. I'm not going to pretend it's not.
So. You can always bribe the Radcliffe family with food, huh?
Always, always.
Nice.
And an opportunity. Well, the danger, of course, is putting them in an environment where there are lots of people since they like to run free. But
yeah.
But we can overcome that. So, JP, anything new coming on Time Warner Cable Sports Channel this week?
Well, we finally get to air our basketball play of the year. The season ended about a month and a half ago. Then you add in some... Well, no, but then you add in some voting time, give people a chance to watch the plays and vote, and then we try and schedule a trophy presentation or check presentation for a school assembly or something big, and we finally got it. So that will be on tomorrow's show, as well as a story about the Kenosha Tremper baseball team, because they're really good. They don't know if it's ever been done in Wisconsin before. They have up to 6 or 7 college baseball recruits on their roster. Very impressive. So went down there to talk about that little collection of talent, and then obviously NFL draft coverage as well.
At lakecountrynow.com, you can find a story that's getting a lot of initial traction, a story about Maguanago track and field sprinter Grace Harris. And she's interesting because she actually doesn't attend Maguanago High School. She's homeschooled, and a new law, which went into effect for this school year, allows homeschooled kids to participate in athletics within their district at a neighboring school. So her family lives in the Maguanago district. She's able to compete for Maguanago in track and field. She's a senior. She won a conference title in the 55-meter dash in the indoor season. So that's an interesting story, just because it's, you know, somebody who's new to the team doing great, but also just the broader change to the WIAA and the state of Wisconsin that sort of allows this thing to happen. A lot of people interested in that story so far. And plus, you could check out my Preps alcove at lakecountrynow.com. Molly Seidel, the superstar Notre Dame distance runner, she's already got 4 national titles under her belt. She won 12 state titles while she was in Wisconsin at University Lake School out in Heartland. She is looking toward the Olympics. She's already qualified in 1 of her 2 events for the Olympic trials in Oregon, which is at the beginning of July. She presumably is going to be good enough to make it to Rio de Janeiro. She's just one of the elite distance runners in the country right now, 21 years old, about to graduate from Notre Dame, and obviously big things ahead. It's nice that the Olympics slot in nicely right after her college career, so she's in a really good spot in terms of her age with being only 21 and being right now at the top of her game. So definitely caught up with her and try to find out what she's working on next, which is running far and very fast.
Very nice. I remember I did a story on her as well, trying to chase her and catch up with her in the woods out in Heartland, trying to get just any clips I could to use in that story. But yeah, very cool. She is quite good.
Well, JP, thanks for joining me once again on the Initial Reaction podcast.
My pleasure. My pleasure, buddy.
Yes. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right. See ya. Thanks, friends.